Friends, welcome. Chasing History, Stories Behind Lost Legends, has a gift for finding the stories we collectively agreed to look away from and then looking directly at them anyway. In the mid-19th century, the world resembled a bizarre carnival where curiosity and cruelty danced a macabre waltz. Picture it, a society that thrived on the bizarre, where being different was less about individuality and more about your next ticket to the freak show. If you had an unusual quirk or a genetic anomaly, congratulations. You were officially the main attraction, ready for your close-up under the flickering gaslights while the audience munched on popcorn, delighting in the spectacle of human misfortune. Who needs reality TV when you can gawk at living curiosities? Welcome to a time when the strange and the sad were paraded for amusement, and empathy was, well, left outside the tent. Julia Pastrana stood at a petite 4'5", a pint-sized powerhouse of peculiarities that had nature's sense of humor on overdrive. She was graced with not one, but two rare conditions that turned her into a living punchline: hypertrichosis, terminalis, which cloaked her body in dense hair, and gingival hyperplasia, resulting in her distinctive jaw prominence. But she wasn't the first one with this condition. Petrus Gonsalvus, a 16th century figure often referred to as the man with the fur, was a remarkable individual who captured Europe's fascination because of his extraordinary condition. Born in the Canary Islands around 1537 into slavery, Gonsalvus exhibited an unusual amount of body hair, which led to his capture and eventual presentation at the court of King Henry II and Catherine de' Medici of France. His life story is both a tale of human resilience and a reflection of societal attitudes toward physical differences during the Renaissance. Gonsalvus became a subject of curiosity and spectacle, yet he also defied these labels by marrying and fathering children, some of whom inherited his rare condition. 2. The details of Julia's childhood remain shrouded in historical uncertainty. Still, we are fairly certain that she was born within the state of Sinaloa, Mexico, in a small village called Ocaroni. According to the colorful oral histories collected by Ricardo Mimiaga, Julia's entry into the world was about as smooth as a circus tightrope act. Her mother either met an untimely demise shortly after Julia's birth, or, in a dramatic turn, worthy of a telenovela, might have bolted the moment she caught sight of her daughter's striking features. As for her father, well, he vanished into the ether, leaving Julia to be raised by an uncle, because nothing says family values like being shuttled off to live with the relative who drew the short straw. As fate would have it, Julia found herself under the roof of Pedro Sanchez, Sinaloa's former governor, in the mid-1850s, a setting that must have felt like moving from a sideshow tent to a royal court, albeit a rather peculiar one. Historical accounts suggest that this was the moment she began to blossom artistically, transforming from a living curiosity into a mezzo-soprano vocalist and trained dancer. While most people were busy learning the local gossip, Julia was busy mastering the art of performance, turning her unique circumstances into a stage presence that would leave audiences spellbound. She didn't stop at her native Cajita. Oh no, she decided to throw in Spanish, English, and French for good measure. Francisco Sepúlveda, the maritime customs overseer in Mazatlan, had a knack for questionable investments, and his purchase of Julia from Pedro Sanchez was no exception. Rumor has it that Julia was already making a name for herself on the circuit, dazzling audiences as part of a traveling freak show. Think of it as the original human carnival, where oddities weren't merely sideshows, but the star attractions. Picture the scene, a raucous tent filled with gasps and giggles, while Julia took center stage, hair flowing and jawline prominent, captivating the crowd with her voice and dance moves. For Sepúlveda, buying Julia was like ordering the deluxe package of peculiarities. He didn't just acquire a performer, he snagged a living legend who could turn any dull night into a spectacle of bizarre beauty. Historian Irineo Paz uncovers a rather bizarre partnership, revealing that Sepúlveda didn't just strike a deal with the Sinaloan governor, but also teamed up with Theodore Lent, an American entrepreneur whose taste for the peculiar was rivaled only by his ambition. Together, these two masterminds orchestrated a delightfully macabre business venture, showcasing Julia Pastrana across the United States. In other words, Julia was sold for entertainment. Again. Side note, the historical record leaves us in the dark about Julia's early years, offering little more than whispers of her past and a jumble of generational folklore. We're left with no personal accounts to guide us, making it challenging to sift through fact from fiction. What I've shared here is the most credible narrative based on the evidence at hand, but who knows? Future discoveries might turn this entire story on its head, adding unexpected twists to an already enigmatic life. By December 1854, Julia's name blazed across the marquee of Broadway's Gothic Hall Musical Theater, where audiences flocked to gawk at what the posters called the marvelous hybrid or bear woman. Like Julia, Theodore Lent remains a shadowy historical figure. However, recent scholarship portrays him as a silver-tongued opportunist with fingers in many pies, from auctioneering to sales to occasional forays into the flesh trade, prostitution. Now for a twist in the tale that's as complicated as it is intriguing. What we know for certain is that Lent and Julia tied the knot in November 1855 with a marriage license application serving as the official proof of their union. But beyond that, the details become murky. Was it a love story, a business arrangement, or perhaps a blend of both? The nuances of their relationship remain shrouded in mystery, leaving us to ponder what truly transpired behind the scenes of this unconventional partnership. The marriage certainly caused a stir in the community. Court records show that Lent found himself standing before Justice Lauder, facing a $500 fine and questions about the legitimacy of the union, specifically whether his bride had come to him willingly or through abduction. Contrary to expectations, Lent appeared before the judge on the appointed day, and a news article dated November 11, 1855, reported the matter concluded thus: "Trouble about a hybrid. One of the singular specimens of creation in the form of a hairy woman has created quite a contest between the parties having her in charge. It appears that since her arrival to the city, she has been joined in wedlock to a young man named Lent, who disputed the further authority of the agent J.M. Beach. A warrant was issued on Friday evening for the arrest of the alleged husband and his brother. When a partial examination took place, and the certificate of the marriage was produced, the ceremony having taken place on the morning of that day. The right of the husband to the wife could not be doubted, and the magistrate could only hold the husband to bail to produce her when he should demand her presence. She stated on Saturday that she was married and would not give up her husband for anybody. Her face is entirely covered, except on the cheeks under the eye, with a black hair, and her whiskers are quite luxuriant. Unlike all other specimens of humanity, her gums project in front and are entirely longer than the teeth, which are very small and entirely obstructed from view except in the lower jaw. The matter will probably undergo further investigation." Julia's journey was nothing short of epic, taking her from the vibrant theaters of the U.S., to the opulent stages of Europe and even into the far-flung reaches of Russia. Talk about a world tour that could rival today's pop stars. Despite the often grim and grueling conditions that accompanied her life on the road, think cramped train carriages and less than glamorous living arrangements, Julia managed to radiate a warmth and charisma that captivated audiences everywhere. It was as if she had a superpower. No matter how harsh the spotlight or how cruel the world outside, she could charm a crowd with a smile and a song. Audiences were drawn not just to her unique appearance, but to the undeniable spirit that shone through, turning what could have been a tragic tale into one of resilience and enchantment. Julia wasn't just performing, she was rewriting the script on what it meant to be extraordinary in a world that often preferred the ordinary. The irony? Her talent was overshadowed by the very condition that made her famous. I find myself questioning the conditions of her performances. Was she afforded moments of respite between performances, time for meals, a chance to breathe? I picture children encountering her, what expressions crossed their faces. And the adults, did they maintain decorum, or did their curiosity manifest as inappropriate commentary? Perhaps, contrary to my assumptions, she received the dignity one human owes another. Most likely not, though. Julia wasn't merely on display. She was dissected by doctors who circled her like vultures, hoping to make the next great medical discovery. They debated her humanity, comparing her bestial characteristics to those of normal humans in hopes of unearthing the link between us and them. I'm relieved to report that a handful of physicians recognized Julia's condition for what it was, not some medical oddity to be gawked at, but rather a documented ailment that simply doesn't cross most doctors' desks. In 1859, while Julia was navigating the glittering yet unforgiving world of Russia, tragedy struck with a heart-wrenching blow. At just 26 years old, she gave birth to a son, a moment that should have been filled with joy and promise. Instead, the newborn's life was tragically cut short, passing away just days after entering the world. The profound heartache that Julia must have felt as a mother is unimaginable, a sorrow that would linger long after the loss. And if you thought her journey was already a circus, let's not forget the delightful addition of her husband, who had a unique entrepreneurial spirit of his own. While Julia was navigating the stormy seas of grief, he decided that the time of mourning was the perfect moment to cash in on her fame. That's right. He sold tickets for people to visit her, as if she were some macabre museum exhibit. But the darkness didn't end there. In a chilling twist of fate, Julia's story took an even more sinister turn after her untimely death just days later. In a shocking display of greed, her husband made a deal that would make any horror movie plot seem tame. He sold her body to a scientist who had a penchant for the grotesque. This scientist didn't just put Julia on display. He stuffed her alongside her newborn son, transforming their tragic ends into a morbid spectacle, an eternal exhibit that blurred the lines between science and macabre curiosity. But Lent wasn't finished with his bizarre entrepreneurial escapades just yet. In a twist straight out of a carnival sideshow, he quickly married another bearded lady from Germany, proving that he had a type and a flair for the dramatic. Together, they hit the road, embarking on a tour that was both a tribute to Julia's legacy and a bizarre spectacle of its own. Imagine the promotional posters. Two bearded beauties under one tent. It's the kind of marketing that would make any modern-day promoter green with envy. The saga of Julia and little Theodore took yet another tragic turn after being purchased by Earl Jagerlund in 1921. As a Norwegian show promoter, he displayed their remains at his amusement park and took them on tours, extending their grim story of exploitation well into the 1970s. By 1972, public sentiment had shifted significantly, leading to enough outcry about the horrendous spectacle that their remains were finally put into storage at the Oslo Fairground. However, this was just the beginning of their further mistreatment. In 1976, vandals broke into the fairground and damaged Julia's body, showcasing a disturbing lack of respect for the deceased. Tragically, they threw little Theodore's body into a ditch, where it was left vulnerable and ultimately devoured by mice, a heartbreaking end for a child who had already faced so much. In 1979, the nightmare continued when Julia's body was stolen, only to be recovered shortly after in a suburban garbage dump. To add insult to injury, her arm was severed, a shocking act that reflected the continued disregard for her dignity. For, After a lifetime of twists and turns worthy of a Gothic novel, Julia's body found itself shacked up at the Institute of Forensic Medicine at the Oslo University Hospital, where it was left to collect dust from 1997 until 2013. Indeed, the debate over Julia and her son's remains sparked significant controversy, reflecting differing opinions on ethics, science, and respect for the deceased. Some advocated for holding onto their bodies for future scientific research, particularly with advancements in DNA analysis. The potential to unlock insights into their unique conditions or contributions to medical science was tantalizing, prompting some quarters to push to preserve them for study. On the other side were those who argued passionately for a respectful burial. They emphasized the importance of honoring Julia and her son's lives and legacies, advocating that they deserved rest after enduring so much exploitation and suffering. This clash of perspectives highlighted broader ethical questions about the treatment of human remains, especially those of individuals whose lives had already been marred by public spectacle and commercial exploitation. The discussion surrounding their fate reflected ongoing societal debates about the intersection of science, ethics, and respect for individual lives. In 2005, while in Oslo for an artist residency, Mexican artist Laura Anderson Barbeda stumbled upon Julia Pastrana's haunting story and felt compelled to take action. With a heart full of determination and a dash of righteous indignation, she began campaigning for Julia's body to be repatriated to Mexico for the proper Catholic burial that had eluded her for far too long. It was an uphill battle, as Julia had spent decades as a tragic spectacle, and now her legacy was tangled in bureaucratic red tape. Years passed before Barbeda's efforts gained traction, but in 2008, she submitted paperwork to Norway's National Committee for the Evaluation of Research on Human Remains. By then, discussions about the ethical treatment of human remains were gaining momentum, and the committee's eventual admission that Julia likely wouldn't have wanted to be treated as a specimen was a bittersweet acknowledgement. After a lifetime of being paraded around like a carnival attraction, the last thing Julia needed was to continue her bizarre journey as an academic curiosity. In a poignant turn of events, Mexican Ambassador Martha Bárcena Coqui, stationed in Copenhagen, Denmark, formally received Julia Pastrana's long-awaited coffin during a ceremony at Oslo University Hospital. It was a bittersweet moment, marking the end of a tragic chapter and the beginning of a long-overdue homecoming. The journey to honor Julia was nothing short of ceremonial. Her coffin was flown from Oslo to Paris, then from Paris to Mexico City, and finally to Culiacán, the capital of Sinaloa. Upon arrival, Julia was greeted with military honors, a fitting tribute to a woman who had endured so much suffering. Following her grand entrance, she was whisked away to a military base where a press conference shed light on her tumultuous story. A small memorial service followed, allowing those who remembered her legacy to pay their respects. The next day, she was transported to Sinaloa de Leyva for her final resting place, where she was finally laid to rest. Final thoughts. Julia Pastrana's tale is a haunting reminder of how society has treated those who do not fit the mold. In a world still grappling with issues of inclusion and acceptance, her story resonates with the plight of many who have been marginalized or objectified. In the end, it leaves us with a darkly humorous yet sobering question. What does it say about humanity when we seek amusement in others' misfortune? Julia's life reminds us to reflect on our own views of normalcy and to consider how we can create a world where differences are celebrated rather than exploited. Until next time, friends, keep reading and stay caffeinated.